Chapter 41. Coming out of the bright light of the studio, I didn't make out Therese very distinctly. She, however, having groped in dark cupboards, must have had her pupils sufficiently dilated to have seen that I had my hat on my head. This has its importance, because after what I had said to her upstairs, it must have convinced her that I was going out on some midnight business. I passed her without a word, and heard behind me the door of the studio close with an unexpected crash. It strikes me now that under the circumstances I might have without shame gone back to listen at the keyhole. But truth to say, the association of events was not so clear in my mind as it may be to the reader of this story. Neither were the exact connections of persons present to my mind. And, besides, one doesn't listen at a keyhole, but in pursuance of some plan, unless one is afflicted by a vulgar and fatuous curiosity. But that vice is not in my character. As to plan, I had none. I moved along the passage between the dead wall and the black and white marble elevation of the staircase with hushed footsteps, as though there had been a mortally sick person somewhere in the house. And the only person that could have answered to that description was Señor Ortega. I moved on, stealthy, absorbed, undecided, asking myself earnestly, "What on earth am I going to do with him?" That exclusive preoccupation of my mind was as dangerous to Señor Ortega as typhoid fever would have been. It strikes me that this comparison is very exact. People recover from typhoid fever, but generally the chance is considered poor. This was precisely his case. His chance was poor, though I had no more animosity towards him than a virulent disease has against the victim it lays low. He really would have nothing to reproach me with. He had run up against me, unwittingly, as a man enters an infected place, and now he was very ill indeed. No, I had no plans against him. I had only the feeling that he was in mortal danger. I believe that men of the most daring character, and I make no claim to it, often do shrink from the logical processes of thought. It is only the devil, they say, that loves logic. But I was not a devil. I was not even a victim of the devil. It was only that I had given up the direction of my intelligence before the problem, or rather that the problem had dispossessed my intelligence, and reigned in its stead side by side with a superstitious awe. A dreadful order seemed to lurk in the darkest shadows of life. The madness of that Carlist with the soul of a Jacobin, the vile fears of Baron H., that excellent organizer of supplies, the contact of their two ferocious stupidities, and last, by a remote disaster at sea, my love brought into direct contact with the situation. All that was enough to make one shudder not at the chance, but at the design. For it was my love that was called upon to act here, and nothing else. And love which elevates us above all safeguards, above restraining principles, above all littlenesses of self-possession, yet keeps its feet always firmly on earth, remains marvelously practical in its suggestions. I discovered that however much I had imagined I had given up Rita, that whatever agonies I had gone through, my hope of her had never been lost. Plucked out, stamped down, torn to shreds, it had remained with me secret, intact, invincible. Before the danger of the situation it sprang, full of life, up in arms the undying child of immortal love. What incited me was independent of honor and compassion. It was the prompting of a love supreme, practical, remorseless in its aim. It was the practical thought that no woman need be counted as lost forever, unless she be dead. This excluded for the moment all considerations of ways and means and risks and difficulties. Its tremendous intensity robbed it of all direction, and left me adrift in the big black and white hall, as on a silent sea. It was not, properly speaking, irresolution. It was merely hesitation as to the next immediate step, and that step even of no great importance. Hesitation merely as to the best way I could spend the rest of the night. I didn't think further forward for many reasons, more or less optimistic, but mainly because I have no homicidal vein in my composition. The disposition to gloat over homicide was in that miserable creature in the studio, the potential Jacobin, in that confounded buyer of agricultural produce, the punctual employee of Hernandez Brothers, the jealous wretch with an obscene tongue, and an imagination of the same kind to drive him mad. I thought of him without pity, but also without contempt. I reflected that there were no means of sending a warning to Dona Rita in Tolosa, for of course no postal communication existed with the headquarters. And moreover, what would a warning be worth in this particular case, supposing it would reach her, that she would believe it, and that she would know what to do? How could I communicate to another that certitude which was in my mind, the more absolute, because without proofs, that one could produce? The last expression of Rosa's distress rang again in my ears. Madam has no friends. Not one. And I saw Dona Rita's complete loneliness beset by all sorts of insincerities, surrounded by pitfalls, her greatest dangers within herself, in her generosity, in her fears, in her courage too. What I had to do first of all was to stop that wretch at all costs. I became aware of a great mistrust of Therese. I didn't want her to find me in the hall, but I was reluctant to go upstairs to my rooms from an unreasonable feeling that there I would be too much out of the way, not sufficiently on the spot. There was the alternative of a livelong night of watching outside, before the dark front of the house. It was a most distasteful prospect. And then it occurred to me that Blunt's former room would be an extremely good place to keep a watch from. I knew that room. When Henry Alliger gave the house to Rita in the early days, long before he made his will, he had planned a complete renovation, and this room had been meant for the drawing room. Furniture had been made for it specially, upholstered in beautiful ribbed stuff, made to order, of dull gold color with a pale blue tracery of arabesques and oval medallions enclosing Rita's monogram, repeated on the backs of chairs and sofas, and on the heavy curtains reaching from ceiling to floor. To the same time, belonged the ebony and bronze doors, the silver statuette at the foot of the stairs, the forged iron balustrade reproducing right up the marble staircase Rita's decorative monogram in its complicated design. Afterwards the work was stopped, and the house had fallen into disrepair. When Rita devoted it to the Carlist cause, a bed was put into that drawing room, just simply the bed. The room next to that yellow salon had been in Alliger's young days fitted as a fencing room containing also a bath, and a complicated system of all sorts of shower and jet arrangements, then quite up to date. That room was very large, lighted from the top, and one wall of it was covered by trophies of arms of all sorts, a choice collection of cold steel disposed on a background of Indian mats and rugs. Blunt used it as a dressing room. It communicated by a small door with the studio. I had only to extend my hand, and make one step to reach the magnificent bronze handle of the ebony door, and if I didn't want to be caught by Therese, there was no time to lose. I made the step, and extended the hand, thinking that it would be just like my luck, to find the door locked. But the door came open to my push. In contrast to the dark hall, the room was most unexpectedly dazzling to my eyes, as if illuminated a giorno for a reception. No voice came from it, but nothing could have stopped me now. As I turned round to shut the door behind me noiselessly, I caught sight of a woman's dress on a chair, of other articles of apparel scattered about. The mahogany bed with a piece of light silk which Therese found somewhere, and used for a counterpane, was a magnificent combination of white and crimson between the gleaming surfaces of dark wood. And the whole room had an air of splendor with marble consoles, gilt carvings, long mirrors and a sumptuous Venetian luster depending from the ceiling. A darkling mass of icy pendants catching a spark here and there from the candles of an 8-branched candelabra standing on a little table near the head of a sofa which had been dragged round to face the fireplace. The faintest possible whiff of a familiar perfume made my head swim with its suggestion. I grabbed the back of the nearest piece of furniture, and the splendor of marbles and mirrors, of cut crystals and carvings, swung before my eyes in the golden mist of walls, and draperies round an extremely conspicuous pair of black stockings thrown over a music stool which remained motionless. The silence was profound. It was like being in an enchanted place. Suddenly a voice began to speak, clear, detached, infinitely touching in its calm weariness. "Haven't you tormented me enough today?" it said. My head was steady now, but my heart began to beat violently. I listened to the end without moving. "Can't you make up your mind to leave me alone for tonight?" it pleaded with an accent of charitable scorn. The penetrating quality of these tones, which I had not heard for so many, many days, made my eyes run full of tears. I guessed easily that the appeal was addressed to the atrocious Therese. The speaker was concealed from me by the high back of the sofa, but her apprehension was perfectly justified. For was it not I who had turned back Therese the pious, the insatiable, coming downstairs in her nightgown to torment her sister some more? Mere surprise at Dona Rita's presence in the house was enough to paralyze me, but I was also overcome by an enormous sense of relief, by the assurance of security for her and for myself. I didn't even ask myself how she came there. It was enough for me that she was not in Tolosa. I could have smiled at the thought that all I had to do now was to hasten the departure of that abominable lunatic for Tolosa. An easy task, almost no task at all. Yes, I would have smiled, had not I felt outraged by the presence of Señor Ortega under the same roof with Dona Rita. The mere fact was repugnant to me, morally revolting, so that I should have liked to rush at him, and throw him out into the street. But that was not to be done for various reasons. One of them was pity. I was suddenly at peace with all mankind, with all nature. I felt as if I couldn't hurt a fly. The intensity of my emotion sealed my lips. With a fearful joy tugging at my heart, I moved round the head of the couch without a word. In the white fireplace on a pile of white ashes, the logs had a deep crimson glow, and turned towards them, Dona Rita reclined on her side, enveloped in the skins of wild beasts like a charming and savage young chieftain before a campfire. She never even raised her eyes, giving me the opportunity to contemplate mutely that adolescent, delicately masculine head, so mysteriously feminine in the power of instant seduction, so infinitely suave in its firm design, almost childlike in the freshness of detail, altogether ravishing in the inspired strength of the modeling. That precious head reposed in the palm of her hand. The face was slightly flushed with anger, perhaps. She kept her eyes obstinately fixed on the pages of a book which she was holding with her other hand. I had the time to lay my infinite adoration at her feet, whose white insteps gleamed below the dark edge of the fur out of quilted blue silk bedroom slippers, embroidered with small pearls. I had never seen them before. I mean the slippers. The gleam of the insteps too, for that matter. I lost myself in a feeling of deep content, something like a foretaste of a time of felicity which must be quiet, or it couldn't be eternal. I had never tasted such perfect quietness before. It was not of this earth. I had gone far beyond. It was as if I had reached the ultimate wisdom beyond all dreams and all passions. She was that which is to be contemplated to all infinity. The perfect stillness and silence made her raise her eyes at last, reluctantly, with a hard defensive expression which I had never seen in them before. And no wonder. The glance was meant for Therese and assumed in self-defense. For some time its character did not change, and when it did it turned into a perfectly stony stare of a kind which I also had never seen before. As he had never wished so much to be left in peace. As he had never been so astonished in her life. As he had arrived by the evening express only 2 hours before Señor Ortega, had driven to the house, and after having something to eat, had become for the rest of the evening the helpless prey of her sister, who had fawned and scolded and wheedled and threatened in a way that outraged all Rita's feelings. Seizing this unexpected occasion, Teresa displayed a distracting versatility of sentiment. Rapacity, virtue, piety, spite, and false tenderness while, characteristically enough, she unpacked the dressing bag, helped the sinner to get ready for bed, brushed her hair, and finally, as a climax, kissed her hands, partly by surprise and partly by violence. After that, as he had retired from the field of battle slowly, undefeated, still defiant, firing as a last shot the impudent question. Tell me only, have you made your will, Rita? To this poor Dona Rita with the spirit of opposition strung to the highest pitch answered. Oh, and I don't mean to being under the impression that this was what her sister wanted her to do. There can be no doubt, however, that all Therese wanted was the information. Rita, much too agitated to expect anything but a sleepless night, had not the courage to get into bed. She thought she would remain on the sofa before the fire and try to compose herself with a book. As she had no dressing gown with her, she put on her long fur coat over her nightgown, threw some logs on the fire, and lay down. She didn't hear the slightest noise of any sort till she heard me shut the door gently. Quietness of movement was one of Teresa's accomplishments, and the harassed heiress of the Alleger Millions naturally thought it was her sister coming again to renew the scene. Her heart sank within her. In the end, she became a little frightened at the long silence, and raised her eyes. She didn't believe them for a long time. She concluded that I was a vision. In fact, the first word which I heard her utter was a low, odd no, which, though I understood its meaning, chilled my blood like an evil omen. It was then that I spoke. "Yes," I said, "it's me that you see," and made a step forward. She didn't start. Only her other hand flew to the edges of the fur coat, gripping them together over her breast. Observing this gesture, I sat down in the nearest chair. The book as he had been reading slipped with a thump on the floor. "How is it possible that you should be here?" she said, still in a doubting voice. "I am really here," I said. "Would you like to touch my hand?" She didn't move at all. Her fingers still clutched the fur coat. "What has happened?" "It's a long story, but you may take it from me that all is over. The tie between us is broken. I don't know that it was ever very close. It was an external thing. The true misfortune is that I have ever seen you." This last phrase was provoked by an exclamation of sympathy on her part. She raised herself on her elbow and looked at me intently. "All over," she murmured. "Yes, we had to wreck the little vessel. It was awful. I feel like a murderer. But as he had to be killed. Why? Because I loved her too much. Don't you know that love and death go very close together? I could feel almost happy that it is all over if you hadn't had to lose your love. Oh, amigo George, it was a safe love for you." "Yes," I said. "T was a faithful little vessel. She would have saved us all from any plain danger. But this was a betrayal. It was never mind. All that's past. The question is, what will the next one be? Why should it be that? I don't know. Life seems but a series of betrayals. There are so many kinds of them. This was a betrayed plan, but one can betray confidence, and hope and desire, and the most sacred." "Dot, but what are you doing here?" she interrupted. "Oh, yes. The eternal why. Till a few hours ago I didn't know what I was here for. And what are you here for?" I asked. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.